there's so much hope. There's hope, so much expectancy. Life is so much richer if we have this sense of the eternal, of eternity always coming in on our seen reality. There's a lot more going on than we think there is.
This week, we highlight a past episode of our Faith and Imagination podcast. Robin Wrigley Carr is Associate Professor in Theology and Spirituality at Alpha Crucis College in Sydney, Australia. She serves on the editorial board and is book review editor for the Journal for the Study of Spirituality. She's written extensively about the 20th century Anglo-Catholic writer, mystic, and spiritual retreat leader Evelyn Underhill, and is the author of Archbishop of York's Advent Book for 2021, Music of Eternity, Meditations for Advent with Evelyn Underhill. On this episode, Matthew Wickman of BYU's Faith and Imagination Institute speaks with Robin about the interplay between loving God and loving others, as well as her Advent book.
I had been looking for a guest with whom I might discuss something related to Christmas, as we're now, at the time this podcast is being released, well into December. Then I came across this beautiful book about Advent, titled Music of Eternity, and I knew I found the perfect guest if she would agree to come on the podcast. So, Robin Wrigley Carr, thank you so much, and zooming in from Australia, no less.
It's a pleasure to be here, Matt. Thanks.
Now, I ask our guests how faith figures into their life and work, and I'm interested in your journey. You're Australian, right? But you got your PhD at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. So what took you there, and what were you working on for your degree?
Yeah, so probably need to back a little bit before the PhD. I actually was living in London a long time ago, working in publishing, and I got a desire to study theology and spirituality, and ended up at Regent College in Vancouver. Did my master's there, and then was back in Australia working as a lecturer in spirituality, and always had this desire to do a PhD, and I got a scholarship to go to St. Andrews, and I worked on a religious philosopher, a Catholic layman called Baron Friedrich von Hugel, and looked at his letters of spiritual nurture. Now, interestingly, he was the main spiritual director who influenced Evelyn. So you can see that I'd been working on the Baron, and then later I really started working on Evelyn's writing since about 2016.
Okay, great. And I have a couple of your books, actually, this one and another book that you published on Evelyn Underhill. Another question about your interests and background. You know, you and I belong to a couple of the same societies. We're both members of the Society for the Study of Christian Spirituality. You're on the executive board for the International Network for the Study of Spirituality. And there's so much written these days about the relationship between religion and spirituality, especially regarding the tensions between the two. I mean, the phrase, for example, spiritual but not religious. So my question is this. Has your scholarly interest in spirituality exerted any kind of change, you know, better, worse, or neutral, on your religious life?
It's a great question. My master's thesis was on Teresa of Avila, and it was looking particularly at humility, authentic self-knowledge, knowing ourselves in the light of who God is. And certainly I find that phrases from her writings resonate with me, from immersing myself in her work. And then certainly the Baron von Hugel, I find myself with quotes from his letters that he wrote to spiritual directees resonate with me. And I think, you know, when you work intensely with good people that are writing good, rich materials, they become friends. They become people whose thoughts and words start working into our lives. And certainly that's been the case most recently with Evelyn Underhill's writings, who I'm immersed in at the moment. I think your earlier question about INSS, the International Network for the Study of Spirituality, I'm really interested in the idea of spiritual longing and spiritual health for all of humanity, not just the Christian population. And some of the work that I've done in terms of spiritual care for people with dementia That resonates with some of the work of INSS, who one of their interests is the whole idea of spiritual care and spirituality and health.
Yeah, that's great. And that would be a wonderful place actually to engage in. My wife is a therapist, and she doesn't work much with people with dementia, but she does work with people who face trauma and addiction. And many of those clients are open to spirituality, and she engages in various spiritual practices with them as a tool for healing. So like what you've been doing in the INSS. Now, you've written this beautiful book about Advent, and most of our listeners will know what Advent is. Many observe Advent. Some may not know. So can you explain briefly what Advent is? And then of particular interest to me, can you tell us why you decided to write a book for Advent?
Okay. So the word Advent comes from the Latin word adventus, meaning arrive or come to. So it's all about the 4 weeks roughly before Christmas, when we're waiting and watching and preparing for the coming of the Christ child at Christmas. So this particular book that I've written for this year, the Advent dates are from Sunday the 28th of November through to Christmas Eve. And I've just provided a daily reading for each day of Advent. And we usually end at Christmas Eve, but I've also had a reading for Christmas Day. It's Peace, Jesus is the Prince of Peace. And I've got one for Boxing Day, the day after Christmas. We call it that in Australia. And it's about Come Lord Jesus. So it's this sense of we're now in this in-between time between when Christ came 2,000 years ago and the second coming, when Jesus will come in glory and every knee shall bow. And in terms of why I decided to write this book, I was invited by the Archbishop of York, Stephen Cottrell. And I must admit that when I was asked to write the book, I had two reactions. My first response came on me. And basically the phrase, "O come, let us adore him," from "O come, all you faithful," the line in the carol, it just was resonating in my heart and my head. And, you know, that's relevant here because adoration of Christ, adoration of God is a very big part of what Evelyn Underhill encourages us towards. And then the second one, I need to be completely honest, was feeling a bit daunted, because Evelyn only really talks about Advent itself in one part of a letter written in about 1940 during World War II and in one retreat talk. So there was a sense in which, right, you know, this lady's written 39 books and hundreds of articles, but there's not that much about Advent. So how am I going to take the readers on an Advent journey when she doesn't actually talk about Advent a great deal? So that became the challenge, because I really believe that a good Advent book takes the reader on a journey in preparation as they wait and watch before Christmas.
Okay. And it's a beautiful journey. I love your book. Two things you said I want to ask you about here. First of all, you say the Archbishop of York asked you to write this book. How do you know him? How did that happen?
Yeah, so back in 2016, I received a small grant to do some research looking at echoes of von Hugel, the guy I did the PhD on, in the writings of Evelyn Underhill. So I'd done a bit of work on Evelyn during my PhD, but it was just a small section. So I went over to the UK and I started at the University of St Andrews, and then I was down in Cambridge looking at an archive, and I was all set to go to London to King's College London, where there's a big Evelyn Underhill archive. And I was all set to go, and then it came upon me really strongly, I should actually go to Pleshy, the retreat house where Evelyn led retreats. Sort of just came upon me really strongly in a way I really couldn't ignore. So I ended up going to Pleshy the next day, and I was going through the archival boxes, and it was in the late afternoon, the last box, and I opened it up, and there inside is this beautiful leather-bound volume with these lovely bronze Celtic clasps, and I open it up, and there's these beautiful red calligraphy headings and I realized there were prayers. And it suddenly dawned on me that I had in my hand Evelyn Underhill's prayer book, which the scholars had said had been lost decades ago. And if it was ever found, it would be such a treasure. And here I was with it. So I suddenly decided, forget King's College London. I need to spend the next week copying out these prayers. And it was quite extraordinary, Matt, because I was sitting here with this material and I looked up and I had this amazing vision. This doesn't usually happen to me. It was a vision like a semicircle of about 9 old women in sort of old-fashioned clothes. They're all clapping as if they're saying, at last someone's found the prayer book. And they're looking at each other and they're smiling and clapping and laughing and looking down and up. And I was just so kind of in awe. And then I looked down and I remember looking across the room and just saying, but I'm just little. And that was just this overwhelming sense. Here's this prayer book. And then I could think of how the last 20 years I've been prepared to do this work. And this is a key idea of prevenience. God sets up work for us to do. That's one of the concepts in the first part of the book. And so I copied out the book and I got in touch with the then Bishop of Chelmsford, who became the Archbishop of York. So this is the same guy, Stephen Cottrell. And he's like, oh, yes, of course, we should get this published. And I went home to Australia, came back 6 weeks later to check my draft with the original to find a second volume had just been unearthed with the same identical red calligraphy headings. So this got published as Evelyn Underhill's prayer book. So this is kind of the connection with Stephen Cottrell. And then when he became Archbishop of York, he'd read my second book, The Spiritual Formation of Evelyn Underhill, where I really talk about the influence of the Baron on her and her as a retreat leader. And then he got in touch with me. It was about March 2020, just as the pandemic was coming, and asked me to write this Advent book. That's a rather long story.
No, it's an amazing story. First of all, I'm a scholar and I've spent plenty of time in archives. And I can't imagine finding something as original and impactful as what you found with that prayer book. That's incredible.
Well, the amazing thing too, Matt, was that with this volume, beautiful volume, that when I first looked at it, I thought it was locked. And then no, I could open it. There was then some paperwork. There was a letter from a Canadian priest who said, I found this years and years ago, and I've been using it as my private devotional. He found it in an Oxfam shop. And he said, I've now realized as I've become old that I want to donate it to the House of Retreat. And he'd posted it. They'd found it they received it in 2004. And there was a letter from the then warden saying, wow, we can't believe this. And apparently it was put in a suitcase for safekeeping. And I just happened to walk in the door when a new manager had been going through the materials in the archive. So it was just a beautiful timing. The whole thing was set up. And it's amazing how this journey has unfolded since 2016.
That's a great story, Robin. Thank you very much. That's really incredible. And it's resulted in many things, among them this book we're talking about today, Music of Eternity. Now, this is a book in four parts, welcoming God's coming, awaiting God's coming, recognizing God's coming, and embracing God's coming. And you discuss through these four sections several observations of Underhill's regarding the nature of God and Christian virtue. Can you tell us a bit about the structure of the book, why it's structured in this way?
Yes, of course. So it starts with God, because Evelyn recognized that a lot of the time we're very self-focused and we start with ourselves, we're obsessed with ourselves. And she said, it's really important that we push our gaze upwards and recognize God, who is always coming to us and who is always there. And so we start with God, welcoming God's coming. And we have this concept of the provenience of God, which is the idea that God is the prime mover, the one who's the initiator, who sets everything up. In the beginning, God, he creates the world, he creates us. And God loved us first, and then we respond with love. So it's this idea of God as the one that is always there, that sets things up. And then part two is the classic Advent waiting, where we await the coming of Christ and we are there in an expectant waiting, attentive to his action, attentive to his ongoing coming. He comes, ever comes. And in that part, I've included a lot of her personal writings in letters to spiritual directors. She was a spiritual director in terms of silence, meditation, contemplation, expectation. So they're sort of the classic Advent waiting sort of ideas. And then part three is all about Christ. So Christ has come. And instead of having the whole book as waiting, I wanted us to gaze at Christ, and not just gaze at Christ in the manger as the Christ child, but Christ the man. Christ the man and his life and his love and his words and his actions. And so we're taken on this journey. This is my favorite part, part three, where we go from the incarnate Christ in the manger to the ascended Christ. And there's some beautiful meditations where she takes us with Christ, for example, on the temptations. She takes us to think about the abiding Christ on the road to Emmaus. And she writes just so beautifully. So this idea of gazing at Christ, it's the longest section. And then the last section, part four, embracing Christ's coming. Christ has come, and now we're in this in-between section between when Christ came and when Christ comes again. And we adore God. What is our response? We adore God. We partake of the Eucharist. We live in sacrificial, humble, loving, forgiving, and peace-giving ways. And then we have this epilogue, which is come, Lord Jesus. So as we live in this in-between time, awaiting his return in the second coming, we look for the life of the world to come and see hints of it everywhere, and we say, come, Lord Jesus. So in some ways, the structure of the book is we start with God and we end with God, and we have these bookends of the mighty symphony of the triune God, Father, Son, and Spirit, who's filling the universe.
That's great. And I really, when I read it, I found the book to be really beautiful. And I know it's not easy to condense as much material as you had with Evelyn Underhill's writings into the structures that we see, but what you have in the book is just really gorgeous. In fact, I jotted down a number of passages, and I thought I wanted to talk to you about some of these. So here's what I did. I took down like 15 or 20 and thought, I can't ask but 15 or 20. So I thought, let me break it down to maybe 3, 4, maybe 5, depending on how much time we have. And you may have some that you also want to talk about on your own. But can I share with you a few passages that I found really moving and get your thoughts on them? And then there are others, Edmund, after these 3 or 4 that you want to share, by all means, feel free. Here is one of them. It's from early in the book. You write this. If our lives are filled with activities and noise, it won't be easy to hear the barely audible music of God's loving presence. He often comes softly in places and ways that surprise us, and his comings are rarely what we expect, so we generally miss their earthly disguise.
Yeah, I think this whole idea of God coming softly, if we even think about the incarnation with the birth of Christ, you know, the Old Testament writers were expecting something altogether different, something showy and big. And here's this little baby born in poverty. And even if we think about, you know, in the Old Testament, 1 Kings, God was not in the earthquake or the fire, but in the gentle whisper. And I think a lot of the time we're expecting something big, and you know, the Holy Spirit is gentle and gently woos us. And a lot of the time we're missing things because we're looking for the wrong thing.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I like one of the words that one often hears people who are spiritual directors speak is the word discernment.
Yes.
And you wouldn't need to discern if it were blaringly obvious.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. No, I really appreciate that. Here's another
one. She has this idea of waiting. If we're going to discern, We need to almost take some time out and space to be able to reflect prayerfully. And a lot of the time we're just on the conveyor belt of activity and we never get off that. So she's always got this idea of having good rhythms in our lives. And, you know, she would always advocate this idea of a morning rhythm of prayer before we set out on our busy day so that we can be still and wait and get centered and then go into our activity, sort of having worked out what's important and what's just noisy, maybe not that important. So that discernment is partly in the waiting so that the contemplative, more centered place is the leaping place for our action.
Yeah, that's great. That ritual of morning prayer to center one, I really believe in that. That's one that I practice myself and is essential, actually, I think, to my wellness of being. Here's another passage that there's so many in this book, Robin, that are just so beautiful and that are great meditations for Advent or really any time. But here's another one that I noted with real interest and have shared with some friends of mine, actually. It reads, it's those who see much who realize how much remains unseen. That's why theologians always have plenty to say about God, while the contemplative can hardly say anything at all. Real prayer is an entering into ignorance.
Yeah, I love that too. And I think Evelyn had this wonderful sense of the mystery of God. Now, I'm a theologian, so I read this and I listen because I know that, and I suppose my passion is spiritual theology rather than systematics. And spiritual theology tends to be more looking at the writings of the mystics. So I mentioned Teresa of Avila earlier. Teresa, when she's writing about God, starts using a lot of metaphors. So when she's going through her interior castle, the more she gets close to the seventh dwelling place, the more there's an increase in the use of symbolic language and metaphors, because it's so difficult to put into words any real experience of God. And I think this whole idea of trying to have clear-cut definitions of who God is, and it's very difficult to put someone who is other into our human language. So, you know, it's the mystics, it's those who have truly seen and experienced God in prayer who have the most to say, yet find it so difficult to say because they're not wanting to make it too small or clear cut. So, you know, I think my take home message with that is become friends with those who have truly encountered God, who write poetically and in metaphorical language, because they've glimpsed things that the theologians possibly haven't.
I think that's profound. I could not agree more. And I love good theology, right? I'm grateful for good systematic theologians and people who can explain the world and while, you know, incorporating theology. But like you, I am especially drawn to spiritual theology, mystical theology, poetry, metaphor, and the like.
Yeah, and Matt, you know, she loved theologians too. She read theology. So she's writing book reviews in The Spectator about amazingly complex theological works. But I think she was a friend of the mystics. And one of her amazing gifts to humanity is the fact that she translated works. She explained some of the insights of mystics in everyday language. And she has a lovely sparkle about her. You know, she's poetic in the way she expresses, and she has a lovely earthiness about her, which I think is why she resonates so much today. Even when her writings, some of them are 100 years old, she still has something to say in our contemporary 21st century.
Absolutely. I myself feel that, you know, when it seems as though I can perceive that or discern that God has graced something, that thing both seems more open to me, but suddenly much deeper and vaster. You know, the things I took as simple suddenly are revealed to be very profound or have lots of depth or lots of layers that I don't understand, that what I understand are surfaces, if that sometimes. Here's another passage that I, again, there's so many of these, Robin, that are so beautiful. Here's another one that I love. We can't forecast the path God's rescue will take. It is never any use saying, I'm getting desperate. Please answer my prayer by the next post and send an open check. God will answer. More probably, he will transform us and use the unlikely looking material already in hand, the loaves and tiny fishes, looking up to heaven, blessing it, and making it do after all.
I think that's quite, I agree, it's beautiful, and it emphasizes again the unexpectedness of God's perpetual comings to us. I think it's easy for us to put limits on how God will come to us. Evelyn keeps wanting to encourage us to be alert to the unexpected and the disguised. And one thing in that quote that struck me just as you said it was, more probably he will transform us. And certainly in this book, she's encouraging us to be open to the Spirit's transformation of us. And even that comes forth when she talks about Christ being birthed in us, Christ being formed in us, spiritual formation. And that's one image in the first part of the book I really love. You know, you think of this pregnant Mary who's waiting expectantly for the Christ to be physically birthed in her. And we as lovers of Jesus need to also have Christ birthed in us. And this is the work of the Spirit. Thankfully, it's not just our job. It's the work of the Spirit as we are in Christ. And I love what von Hugel says when he talks about spiritual formation as being like metamorphic rock. If you go back to your science school days, metamorphic rock is changed fundamentally through pressure and heat. And we get this new rock, as opposed to sedimentary rock, which is like a layer put on the top. So this idea of transformation by the Spirit as Christ is formed in all of us, it's not like we put on a cloak to somehow look spiritual or even look like we've got the fruits of the Spirit. The Spirit works that stuff into us as there is this fundamental change. And I think that's one of the beautiful aspects she invites us to in this first part, is that part of the book, that Christ be formed in us.
Yeah, I think that's very profound. I know in my own experience, some of my most, life-changing answers to prayer have come in the form of no answer at all. You know, where you get the sense that what needs to change is not my circumstances, but something about my character, my capacity to handle something that I, or to discern something, to grow into something. And so, you know, reading that, Evelyn's thoughts there that you compiled there, I really struck me. We have time for me to read one more. And then if you want to do a couple, I'd love to have from yours. I just love your thoughts on one more of these. And Robin, we could talk here for 5 hours and I could keep on reading passages to you, how we could, but no one would listen for the fifth hour. Well, actually they might, but anyway, yeah, okay, here's the last one I want to read to you. This is from deeper on in the book. You write, called upon to practice in their fullness the two great commandments. You can only, and those two great commandments are, of course, to love God and to love our fellow human beings. Yeah. Called upon to practice in their fullness the two great commandments, you can only hope to get the second one right if you're completely controlled by the first. And that depends on the quality of your secret inner life, the quality that makes people catch the love of God from you. That means giving time, patience, effort to cultivating your attention. Do you see the great facts and splendors of religion with an eye of an artist and a lover, or with the eye of a person of business?
Yeah, it's a beautiful quote. And I think What she says there about we can only really love others if we love God is really important. And this is where, again, this emphasis that she has on adoration of God, worship of God, you know, hallowed be your name, as the beginning of the Lord's Prayer, is so important, because it's only as we gaze at Christ, it's only as we adore God that, and as we love God, that we become somehow changed so that we're enabled to love others. I love what she says in the book when she's talking about the Spirit hovering over creation and hovering over our lives. And then she thirdly says, and the Spirit is hovering over the lives of those around us, the people that annoy us, the people we're angry with, the people that we've lost hope with. And this idea that the Spirit keeps hovering over those people as well, and that they're the people for whom we must pray and must love. You know, it's not just an act of the will. It's recognizing we are participating in what the Spirit is doing in those people's lives, but also as we love God, we're enabled to more fully love the people that annoy us, the people we find difficult to forgive. You know, in the last section of the book, she's giving us a lot of challenges. You know, to live in response to the fact Jesus has come means we're asked to live sacrificially, in a costly way. We're asked to live in a forgiving way. We're asked to love, you know, to love others. But it's not just a gritting of the teeth. It's really as we gaze on Christ, as we listen to his words, as we open ourselves up to him transforming us, that he enables us to love us because we become vessels for his love. It's actually his love that is loving others through us. So there's this beautiful, it's a really organic reality. And when she's talking about intercessory prayer, you know, praying for others, I don't know if this is your experience, Matt, but I find as I'm praying for someone, especially someone perhaps I don't like, I start being changed. I start being more compassionate. I start thinking of ways that I might actually be kind. So there is this beautiful interplay between loving God and loving others. It's huge.
I think that's really insightful, Robin, very insightful. It's true. I think that the injunction to love our enemies, for example, or just, yeah, or fill in the blank, love blank, love those who annoy you, right? Love those who are in some ways unkind to us. Love those who are indifferent to us. Love those who refuse us. I think to pray for them is also to seek sort of God's illumination onto who they are in God's eyes. And I think that, right? And that can change how we think about them. It also changes how we think about ourselves. I think to feel inspired by God, I believe, is to find in oneself a sense of self-worth, dignity, value, yeah. Yeah. That we are valued enough for God to condescend to address us. Yeah. And that gives us the strength then to be able to love others. This is what I find, at least.
Yeah, absolutely, Matt. And I think the thing I love in that fourth meditation, which is talking about the Spirit hovering over others, is it's not just the ones that we find annoying, but those for whom we've lost hope. So the people that we love, who are close to us, people in our families, people in our friendship groups, whoever they are, people that are close to us, who we really love and who we're frightened about, who we're fearful of their future, and recognizing the Spirit is hovering over their lives. The Spirit is doing things that are redeeming, and out of the ashes, there are green shoots that we can't yet see, but they're there. And that gives us hope to keep on loving that person and keep on engaging in prayer for that person, trusting God has this in hand. God absolutely adores that person who we also love and who we're anxious about.
You know, Robin, so many people need that hope. I know I do. And I love that thought you share. Thank you very much. But I've shared some of my favorite passages. Do you have one or two of your own that you want us to think about?
There's one quote that is just a beautiful image to hold. And that's when she says, "So many Christians are like deaf people at a concert. They study the program carefully, believe every statement made in it, speak respectfully of the music, but only really hear a phrase now and again. So they have no notion of the mighty symphony that fills the universe, to which our lives are destined to make their tiny contribution. Yet there are plenty of things in our normal experience that imply the existence of that music, that life." And I just find that quote a wonderful reminder about the need for us to stop and to listen and to be attentive, because there is a lot of stuff going on that we miss constantly. And if we were more aware of this fact that God is always coming to us, he comes, that he is always present with us, I think then we would try to stop and be attentive. And I think it would also fill us with a greater peace, a sense that, you know, I'm not here alone on this planet having to somehow cope by myself and feeling a lot of the time that I'm actually not really making a very good fist of life. I am encompassed and I am held, and I am surrounded by the presence of God, and he is carrying me. There's so much hope. There's hope, so much expectancy. Life is so much richer if we have this sense of the eternal, of eternity always coming in on our seen reality. There's a lot more going on than we think there is.
Absolutely. I love that image. I'm a religious person. I spend a lot of time staying with that metaphor there. I spend a lot of time at the symphony, as it were. And even when I hear the music, I often recognize in myself that I'm not understanding what it's doing. And I keep wanting to be able to learn more, to kind of understand better what I'm hearing. I went on a guided tour of our Museum of Art a few weeks ago with somebody, and one of the curators at the museum was pointing out some things in the paintings. Not to myself, I've seen that painting dozens of times. I've never seen that thing in it. Yeah. You know, and I get the sense often that the spiritual life really is like that, you know, that it requires being able to sit and to hear and to see, discern and understand in order to really grasp all the depth and richness that is there.
It's also why we need community.
Yes.
Because I see something that you haven't seen, and you see something that I haven't seen. And a writer like Evelyn, because she was so immersed in the writings of the Christian mystics from all branches of the church, means that she has a wealth of insights that she's gained from them that she can then translate for us. And, you know, we get to see more. Or even, you know, as we immerse ourselves in scripture and see how God has spoken to others, how others have responded to him, we learn. We're part of a community. I think this idea that we're just individuals is such a problem. We need to have a sense of our unity, the diversity of humanity and our unity together, but also the sense of community. So we're not put on this planet by ourselves. We have each other to learn from, to be encouraged by. And certainly, you know, someone like Evelyn, as I said, she has immersed herself in a historic community. She's not just reading the writers of her day, she's reading all the good writers through the centuries who've got something deep and rich to tell us. And she communicates it in ways that our 21st century ears can hear. And I think that's one of the big values of her work.
That actually is music to the ears of a scholar, right? Yeah, preach, Robin. Yes, exactly right. And the importance of an education. Let me just ask you a question here as we close. And I want to thank you again for taking time to come talk with me. This has been wonderful. I'm wondering, does Advent mean something different to you now than it did 10 or 20 years ago? I mean, for that matter, does it mean something different to you now than it did 2 years ago prior to the pandemic?
I'll answer the pandemic part of the question first. I think the pandemic for so many of us has taught us about waiting. We're waiting for the numbers to come down. We're waiting for the vaccination rates to go up. We're waiting for a vaccination that is legit. We're waiting for our turn in the queue. There's been so much waiting. And in the 21st century, we're not very good at waiting. You know, we're all used to fast food. We're used to fast pace of life. So the whole idea of waiting, we've been forced to wait. And we haven't liked it on the whole because it's interrupted our lives. But I actually think that interruption, the gift of the interruption, is that for many of us, it's woken us up. It's woken us up to try to slow down and use that extra bit of time that we have when we're working from home, if we're lucky enough to do that during a pandemic, to, as you said earlier, have rhythms of prayer at the beginning of our day, because we're not rushing out the door. We've got an extra hour, perhaps, that we didn't have before. Or if we're out of work during a pandemic, we've got time. Now, what do we do with that time? Time is a precious commodity. So the waiting idea, you know, that's one of the big parts of Advent. We're waiting for the Christ child. I think the pandemic has helped me slow down. And the challenge as the world's opening up again, and the challenge is another variant's found, and we're not quite sure what that means, is how do we keep some of the gifts we've learned during the pandemic? How do we weave that into our lives as our lives get quicker again? And I suppose as we think about Advent, it's a time when things get faster, I find, in the weeks before Christmas. The shops are racing. There's lots of noise from Christmas carols and Christmas music. There's functions, there's events, there's plans, there's shopping. To actually wait during Advent means that we're being countercultural and intentional, because it doesn't just happen that we're attentive in this busier season. We have to stop and be intentional. But it's almost like a counterpoise to all of the reality around us. In terms of how Advent's changed to 10 to 20 years ago, I think I'd have to ponder that question a bit more, to be honest. I certainly know how it's changed in the last 2 years.
That was a great answer, though. I love that observation on how we really have received, if we can receive it, the gift of learning how to wait. Because a lot of us aren't very good at that in our 21st century. This has been a gift, Robin, to talk with you. This has been so wonderful. This is exactly what I was hoping to have, this kind of conversation in the last podcast before Christmas. Thank you so much for your time and your talents, and for this wonderful book that you've compiled of, again, Music of Eternity, Meditations for Advent with Evelyn Underhill. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Matt, for the invitation, and Advent blessings on all the listeners. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Sophia Snyder and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.